Hello, my name is Sarah Tyson, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Colorado, Denver. Today I'm talking with Dr. Jeffrey Golub, Assistant Professor, Clinical Track, in the Department of Philosophy, about how he is thinking about the pandemic, using the tools and methods of philosophy. Welcome, Jeff. Thanks so much for talking with me today.
Hey, Sarah. Good to talk to you.
So will you tell us a bit about how you got into philosophy?
Yeah. I think there's been a few stories about this, and we all share many of the ways that this began for us. I mean, I was exposed to Plato as a teenager, and I took a philosophy class in high school, and you may already know this, but I went to UCD for my undergrad, so I took philosophy courses there, and then spiraled from that point. But I tried to think about this, and I actually remembered that there's a better story about my entrance to philosophy that I encountered when I was much younger. You want to hear it?
I do.
Well, it's kind of funny, but I think I can't really quite remember the age that I was, but I recall experiencing that other people had noses that I could see, but I couldn't see my own nose without a mirror, of course. And it revealed to me that in a way, I'm this kind of zero point of perspective. And that means that there were perspectives before me and that there may be ones after me. So then I had this growing realization that I was a subject and that I might not be around after I live. And it was quite a bit of anxiety, but I think it was one of my first philosophical insights as a young person.
So when you walked into a philosophy class, your first thought was, there's a name for this.
Precisely. I was like, my nose problem has been solved.
Well, solved. Right? At least other people had it, right?
Precisely.
Yeah, that's amazing. Okay. So fast forward, and you now teach at CU Denver, and you're interesting for you teach in Beijing.
That's right.
So will you tell us about that program?
Yeah, so I teach, it's called the International College of Beijing, and this is a partnership that UC Denver has had with the China Agricultural University in Beijing for the last 25 years. We just celebrated our 25th year anniversary. So I've been teaching there since 2011, but since 2017, I've been rotating between fall semesters in Denver and spring semesters in Beijing.
Yeah, and this year was different.
Will you tell us
what happened? Was this in January that everything changed for ICB, as we call it, the program in Beijing?
Yeah. So, I had finished my semester in the fall in Denver, and then what I typically do is I come to New York City, where I stay between semesters. And while here, the news about the virus first came out of Wuhan around December 31st. Obviously, it was transpiring before then, but this is sort of when the news came out. And so in the U.S., I think the first actual case was around the 15th of January. So, during this time, I'm looking at these updates on my phone, and with this kind of growing sense of anxiety about what would happen with me and the course in China, because I was meant to fly to Beijing on February 16th. So there was enough time for me to sort of see this whole thing play out, but not knowing whether I was going to be traveling to China or not. So, every hour I'm checking the news and watching these numbers go up in China. And meanwhile, I have friends and colleagues who are already in China. And you remember, this is just before the Chinese New Year. So a lot of people are already either planning on traveling or they're in other parts of China that they wouldn't be, like their hometowns and so forth. So I've got, friends in Beijing. I've got a friend that was in Changsha, which is in Hunan, and that's just really close to where Wuhan is. And then another friend's in Xiangqiu, Hunan, that's on the other side. So very close to all of the action here. And as they're closing down the highways and the trains and the airports and so forth, Beijing sort of remained open. And I thought, this could very well play out where I'm still going. So just going day by day. And now this is, of course, in February, still hasn't even surfaced in the consciousness of Americans that it's this kind of distant virus that maybe whatever, but we weren't anywhere near where we are today. So at that time, Denver had just given us a kind of early bit of advice, just don't buy a ticket, just stand by, we'll figure out what's going to happen. So I hadn't. I kind of anticipated that. But the one thing that I was curious about was that I had told you earlier ICB had been running for 25 years, but that's not quite true. You might recall SARS in 2002. And I wasn't aware of this until I did a little bit of research on my own. But ICB had been suspended during that time, possibly all the way up to 2007. So that at that time, you know, this whole concept of remote learning was only in its infancy. I don't know if there was even a possibility of doing online. So I thought, well, if ICB is going to roll out its courses, it could do it online, but I just can't picture that. I mean, our students are scattered all over China. Remember, they had traveled for the holidays and so forth. I've never taught online, much less the current courses I had planned. I didn't have the format for that. There's just no way it could happen. So we thought, all right, we get this news. Put your classes together online. We're going live. The original date, February 24th, we're starting. And I thought, this is just unprecedented. But then, you know, we had been working already in this format for a month when you all in Denver had your transition to online. And of course, you all did it in a week. So I have nothing to say. We all have the same story now. I mean, I was grousing about this back before it was cool, but here we are.
Yeah, and here we are. And you are in New York, right? So this is not, you know, Denver for sure has a lot going on, but New York, I think everybody's been paying a lot of attention because it is such an epicenter here. Mm. And so how is that going in New York?
Yeah, you know, so my life is pretty well. I feel very fortunate to have the situation that I do have. I'm in a comfortable and safe spot. I live just right next to the Hudson River here on the Upper West Side, or the Upper East Side, excuse me. And it's great. We can still go out to the park there and enjoy a good jog or anything there. But the city itself, you know, you hear there's always the background drone of ambulances, and everything is closed except, you know, of course, food and other essentials.
Right. So this, you told me that part of what you've been thinking about is nature. And I just want to clarify, because we're doing this in audio and not writing, that you mean capital N nature. And so often philosophers spend time saying things like, I don't mean capital T truth, or I don't mean capital N nature, but you actually mean capital N nature. So will you talk a little bit about why that's where your philosophical mind has been taking you?
Yeah. It's the concept of a capital N concept is, I suppose, in a way that's something that we do have to set out from. But I think in another way, I think it's interesting that the philosophical tendency to want to do that to concepts, to give them that capital letter, is part of the reason that I thought it was a uniquely interesting concept. Because maybe that's not the case. I think that there's a few ways to look at it. I've been thinking a lot about nature from the Greek perspective, which is my own background. Nature, if you want to call it a kind of central concept with a capital letter, I think for them, from a Greek viewpoint, it's nature is a kind of self-generating principle. And so on the one hand, it's completely inscrutable and mysterious, but on the other hand, for the Greeks, it was very close. It was present and nearby and familiar. And it's something that saturates everything around us. And everything that we see, including ourselves, is shot through as something originary. It's something that's not a thing itself, but kind of a principle of things. It's the most difficult thing to understand, but also, in a way, the best thing to think about, therefore. And I think for me, from a philosophical perspective, that's sufficient. I don't know if we have to go then on to try to classify nature as something that belongs to a conceptual sphere. In fact, that might have been what signals these movements into modern concepts of nature, which I'm also interested in. So I look at this kind of Greek perspective as a starting point, given that it is somewhat arbitrary to start with the Greeks. I mean, it's common in our tradition to do so, but it's clearly not the absolute starting point. But then, you know, on the other hand, seeing nature not just as this kind of underlying substantial principle or whatever, but something that is radically external, something that is outside of us and that we find ourselves kind of grappling in and homeless and unprepared to deal with, and that nature is either indifferent to our suffering or it's actually actively antagonistically seeking it out. And I think that that clearly has a more of a conceptual feel to it. And I don't know if this is a contemporary viewpoint of nature, but it certainly has its history. There's the idea in Hegel, for example, that you know, some of the most early experiences of nature, in contradistinction to certain religious ideas, is that nature was this antagonistic force, and that the only way to preserve ourselves against this liquidating, fundamentally destructive nature is through a covenant with God and this thoroughgoing obedience that keeps us safe, but just barely, and not through any obligation of God's own, because this antagonistic force of nature is always at the gates, and any transgression is sufficient to explain natural disaster. So here, you know, the human being is somehow, in a way, almost alien to the natural world that surrounds us. But obviously, this doesn't have to be the final word on nature either. We have nature as it occurs in modernity and enlightenment, that nature is no longer this indifferent or beneficial force or whatever. It's just dead. It's something to be dissected and understood. And through the power of human reason, through technology, this veil can be pulled back. There's a number of illustrations of this idea of personifications of mathematics or natural science or biology or zoology, and they're all pulling back the veil of nature. And under it, you see this kind of representation of usually it's a female figure with multiple breasts. Have you seen these? So this, mm-hmm. Yeah. And so this idea of pulling back the veil of nature, something Adorno calls, you know, the aim of all of this is just the mastery of nature. I think that seems right to me. But, you know, looking at the possibility that pulling back that veil may actually prove to be the most horrific and terrifying thing, something that Schelling and Nietzsche speak a bit about. We also think, and this is something that's quite new to me, but I've been trying to consider whether thinking about nature in the history of philosophy in this way obviously doesn't have to be the only route to take, because of course there are also ideas of nature as being a kind of home, a giver, a nurturer, something that doesn't need to be studied apart from our place in it, but, you know, a concept of something going to, you know, like an indigenous sense of nature, that it's worth looking at our place in nature and indeed other animals, other living things, trying to avoid the urge of either excluding such things or anthropomorphizing them, seeing nature as only in relative to human life, that canonical philosophy seems to always do. So I think, you know, navigating these ways that nature is thought of, it's really obviously something that can be philosophically rewarding.
Well, and I'm struck by, for you, the way you move through history to do this. So could you just give us maybe a little bit of a sense of what you mean by the Greeks, you know, and like when in time this is, and then you move into ideas like the Enlightenment. So do you mind just talking a little bit about how you ground your philosophical practice in history?
Yeah, thank you. I think I, you know, betray my own background there a bit, because I think, you know, being trained in the history of philosophy, one tends to think that way, and possibly one should seek to untie that sometimes. But you're right to say
that. No, it's totally familiar to me. Yeah, no, I agree, and that's it struck me how this is something we share philosophically. Is history as a place we move to philosophically, which is part of the reason I think it's worth thinking about that.
Yeah, one of my good friends told me grad school philosophy friends, you know, he said, I'm so tired when people say, you know, hey, the Greeks thought this. And he's like, who's the Greeks? I mean, think about how many different people were there on, you know, this geographical area of Greece, but all the different cultures that were there and all the different, you know, the Boeotians and the Athenians, and the Attic Greeks. It's almost incoherent. But yeah, I mean, looking at Greece as if, or the Greeks as if it were some kind of thought, as if it were a self-contained thought that occurs between, you know, the birth of Thales and whatever. But anyway, to answer that question, I think, again, what I thought when I looked at it this way was that for me, you know, Greek philosophy is where I start, but in a way it doesn't have to be Greek philosophy. I think that the Greeks hold open this idea of nature in a kind of genuinely insightful way that's just, I think, worthy to do as a practice of philosophy itself. And, you know, it happens to be colored in ways that are historically dependent, but it still makes me think about, you know, it's the way that I've come to understand and appreciate philosophy. So, you know, one can't help but see from that viewpoint how that understanding of nature has been passed down. And I think for me, you know, coming at an idea of the philosophy of nature, whatever that means, again, the way that I've been trained and the way that I philosophically think is that, you know, one has to confront this notion. I think that, you know, nature is becoming a kind of reified notion of something that for the Greeks may have just been a way of doing philosophy. That's something that we have to confront. So I think inevitably that history has to sort of be rolled back to see how it's been constructed. But again, I think I'm betraying my own philosophical tendencies.
Yeah, no, that's interesting to try to think through, since we are after the Enlightenment, however you want to think about the word after there, that there's a way in which we have to go back through the concepts that shape how we're even reading Aristotle, for instance, right? A thinker from whom we are so separated, and part of that separation is a whole tradition of reading Aristotle that I hear you sort of moving through to try to pick apart. In what ways am I reading Aristotle through the lens of Hegel, for instance?
Yeah, I mean, there's really great ways of thinking about the history of philosophy in ways that are genealogical, which means that they're not necessarily reconstructive, they're not necessarily historical. But, you know, if Heidegger, for example, talks about the history of philosophy as being this kind of path through a forest, and that path can be overgrown with a number of let's say a number of, let's call them concepts that have slowly overtaken that original path. You know, there's something valuable in itself of just trying to retrace that path, of being able to even uncover those questions. I think that's rewarding. And I think that nature is just one of many, many, many paths that we could investigate.
Yeah. And so, you are meant to actually be teaching in Germany in the fall. So will you talk a little bit about that program?
Yeah, thanks. Actually, I was just, the philosophy of nature, it happens to be what I'll be teaching in Germany. We've partnered with the political science department and global studies at Denver, and they've been running this study abroad program called Bridging Cultural Divides in Berlin. And I kind of came on board through Christoph Steves, who's the one that directs the program. And it kind of gave me a chance to think about nature, but to give it a bit more of a circumspective standpoint, because in addition to the philosophy of nature, there's also this political response that I think we're called upon to understand. Knowing that environmental policy, which is what this study abroad program works with, understanding the environmental policy is recognizing our role in it, the role of being a human within nature. The program partners with an institution called Ecologic, which is an institute in Berlin that has been, for the past 20 years, they've been working on environmental policy and sustainable development. And these are things that, you know, I've always held to be important, I think, just sort of, you know, a priori. But, knowing that my philosophical viewpoint can also feed into this, when we talk about, as I was talking about before, you know, human beings being internal or external to this nature, our feelings of closeness to it or alienation from it, it seems to me that understanding climate protection, the status of animals, food, commerce, transportation, energy, air, water, all of it, when we talk about responding to those things that are so not only important to us, but important to ecology in general, we might tend to see that as a political problem, because we tend to see those kinds of things from the viewpoint of, you know, the life world of the horizon of human experience. This is how we get along in nature and progress as a human species and a human culture. But, you know, on the other hand, it's clear that, you know, by the human hand, this ecology has been threatened. It seems strange to say that we can either threaten nature or that we can protect it. It seems that both of those is a bit hubristic, but it seems to be the case that nevertheless, it's clear that certain things have changed. John Locke had said, it's a fantastic passage in the Second Treatise on Government. You know, he talking about this idea of dumb materiality in nature that you work over with labor and it becomes property. And he says something like, you know, nature did great by setting limits to how much the human hand can really change nature. It's just too big. There's no way we could do it all. And I thought, well, you know, we're getting close to that. So I think we can see that, you know, given the range of these ideas of the human being's place in nature, I think that this course in Germany has given me an opportunity to think about taking these ideas and trying to find a basic, concrete, but also phenomenological and ethical continuity with being present in nature. Maybe not just a kind of policy of non-interference, maybe some of that concept of preservation and conservation, but maybe to understand our role in nature as something that's important in the way that nature itself unfolds. But I think most importantly, beyond these kinds of questions, which are still a bit speculative and still a bit abstract, I think that, you know, looking at the situation now, these questions of nature and policy are hand in hand at this point, and they're readily evident. They're in our world at the moment. So how do our relationships to each other in governance, in society, and politics, how do these things work, and how have they changed in the current situation? So, you know, welfare, homelessness, prison populations, lack of medical coverage, debt. You've probably already heard that, you know, the Department of Education has suspended the interest rates on loans and even the payments to loans. But then I think Slate already argued this. Why were they even in place to begin with? So why do we have these institutions that are now being quite detrimental to the people that are under them? Why are they there in the first place? So I think knowing, you know, coming to understand our place in nature, on the one hand, philosophically, and then understanding that from a political perspective and a policy perspective, on the other, beyond just conservation, but really finding our way to live in this world and not be complacent with suffering.
Yeah, I feel like we've just started the conversation. So I'm hoping maybe we can check back in later in the summer and the fall, and we can continue talking about these very rich issues that you've gotten on the table for us.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for chatting.
Yeah, thank you.